Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Peter Deckham. Peter is an LA-based lawyer, that's Los Angeles, a Los Angeles-based lawyer, consultant, and entrepreneur in the fields of entertainment, telecommunications, and, of course, the Internet. Peter's clients have included such Hollywood notables as George Lucas, Paul Haggis, Kanan Ivory Wayans, Ron Howard, John Travolta, and Rob Reiner, among many others, as well as corporate clients such as Sears Roebuck, Pacific Telesis, and Japan Victor Corporation, or JVC. He's been listed in Forbes among the top 100 lawyers in the United States and in Premier Magazine as one of the 50 most powerful people in Hollywood. He's also the author of the recent book, Next, Reinventing Media, Marketing, and Entertainment. Welcome to the show, Peter. It's great to have you.
Hi, Kelly. Good for thank you for having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure. The one thing I left out of that illustrious intro, which I don't want to forget to mention, is some of the teaching that you do, I believe, at UCLA, right?
I taught at UCLA for about 8 years, and then I later on I did something stupid for being a lawyer anyway, and co-taught marketing at Haas Business School at Berkeley. So.
Aha, yes, up in my neck of the woods.
Shamelessness abounded.
Well, before we dive in, as I mentioned, and you know it, I'm a trusted advisor as part of my work, and I want to ask you, because you've been one in your own right, having a trusted advisor is really pretty vital as far as I'm concerned, and I imagine you may agree. I want to hear your feedback on that, and I also want to know who some of your mentors might have been along the way.
It's funny. I sort of stumbled and tripped through my life. I started off saying, I want to be like everybody else and be a film director. Went to film school to get an MFA. Dropped out when people were basically making movies about the color blue. And drifted into television. I was a television news writer, TV cameraman, did a bunch of stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then on a lark, I just sort of applied to UCLA School of Law. Shock and surprise, I got in, did pretty well, and got bored out of my mind, and I set up something called a little quarter-away program at the American Film Institute. And when I drifted over in that direction, a gentleman by the name of Tom Pollack was with the AFI. He was sort of a senior lawyer there, and I created my internship under his aegis. Well, as I graduated, I'd been offered, I did fairly well, I won't go into the specifics, but I did well.
Yeah.
And then I decided I didn't want to work in a big firm, that basically it was just like I couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom Pollack had formed a new firm, and I said, okay, I can go there. And I went there, my first check bounce as life. It was a very small check, and it did bounce. But I was there for 3.5 years, made me partner. 5 years, I was a name partner. Those were pretty quick times. And we stumbled into all kinds of cool clients. You mentioned a couple of them, George Lucas, et cetera. And the rest is histrionics. I mean, history.
And histrionics.
And Tom was my mentor.
Yeah.
Tom basically was one hell of a negotiator. And what he did that I kind of really liked, he was a trend analyst. He looked at numbers. He looked at things that were going on. And he abstracted and projected. And I think that's part of something that I became deeply addicted to myself. Abstracting things that are going on, looking at the numbers left, right, and center, talking to the fears and hopes of the people in the business, and then doing the most dangerous thing in the world, predicting what was going to happen, and even more dangerously, acting on it.
Yeah. But from a mentoring standpoint, I think you probably share the same general approach as I do, which is that you have a gift for seeing a bigger vision for people than they have for themselves. And surely you've mentored others over the years as well.
A lot of lawyers, a lot of creative people along the way.
Yeah.
You give advice. Sometimes people don't take it. Sometimes people do. And you like to think that you're giving the best of which you're capable. Sometimes it falls under the category of tough love, and sometimes it just, you know, trying to help a person figure out who they really are and stop trying to be something they really aren't.
Well, to be sure, and I use the words trusted advisor deliberately, and again, I'm sure you'll concur. Trusted, as in they don't have a lot of people they can trust in this business, and advisor, as in maybe having some perspective that's well thought out beyond where, the limited purview they've got in their worldview.
I'm very close to my clients. I mean, I feel deeply connected to them, and their hopes and dreams mean a lot to me.
Yep.
But I also read incessantly. I blog, and I do a lot of crazy things. I really love looking at numbers. I looking at trends, and I like projecting things. Back in 2003, I wrote a different book, co-wrote it with Pete Seeley. And one of the things I said in it is that movie stars cannot have a useful life in the going forward world. Everyone thought I was nuts. But I said to the world, you know, with a younger audience looking for the cool new next, by definition, a movie star defeats that purpose entirely, unless you're a character actor and able to create something new and exciting as a character actor. But,
yeah,
you know, being an established player, it almost is a turnoff to the younger audiences. You've got to be a character actor.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And, of course, that's a good segue to talk about your book next, which has been described, and I read it myself, as in the context of it being a roadmap for how to succeed at media and messaging in a world of constant social and technological change. Could you give us a brief sketch of what readers should expect to learn that maybe haven't had a chance to read the book yet and should?
Well, the first thing that I did is I said, you know, how many people out there in media marketing and entertainment know that there's massive change, got a kind of a gist of what's going on, but are too terrified to ask the question, what does this mean, or how do I do that, without seeming like utter fools to the people who work for them? So I said, okay, I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to kind of break it down into simplistic rules, because as complicated as change is, there are vectors within change, and there are ways of looking at it. But the one thing that I find absolutely abhorrent is people assume that that which they know or knew is the continuation of that which will be. And what I keep telling everybody, drop in onto the planet as if you were a Martian every couple of months and pick up and look at the rules, look at the way the world works as if you knew nothing. And understand that all the people in the world today, just picture it, 1983 cell phones popped in.
Yep.
Cell phones. Well, wow. That's just such an inherent, what's a cell phone? Is it like a smartphone without smart? I mean, as you go through the transitions, we just had a big ruling on net neutrality. About,
mm-hmm.
you know, January 15th, the FCC redefined broadband.
Yeah, and I want to hold that net neutrality for a little bit later on because I want to
okay.
talk about that more.
Well, so the book approaches it to take a look at the things that matter. First of all,
yep.
try to isolate the variables in your business. Try to find out who your audience is. Number one, the medium is still the message. You know, if you have a great message but you put it on the wrong platform, you lose. You also have to understand who your audience is. And finding out who your audience is or who your market is sounds easy. A lot of people have opinions about who's going to love their product. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, but there are ways of reaching out and finding the appropriate messages and finding the audience you're supposed to do. And then when things go wrong, oh, my God, they never go wrong. It's not as if the Internet is like a massively transparent, anything you do wrong is going to be found by somebody because too many are trolling for it or hacking for it. So you got to really learn how to handle damage control. The recent
yeah.
Sony hack is an indication of what happens when you don't handle it well.
Yeah, and Sony, by example, has had so many that they're almost a case study textbook in their own right, you know, from the most recent hack to a decade ago with the root, you know, the rootkit problem on the label side. So,
everything that's going on in the world, you have so many people whose hobby is disruption. Some
yeah.
are positive disruptors, some are negative disruptors, but the tools for finding everything are just completely available. It used to be that if you went to prison, you could pretend as if, well, you know, maybe I'll find a job. Today, everybody, 9 out of 10 employers do prison checks. So you have an arrest record or conviction record, you're going to get picked up. There are no secrets, and there's very little privacy, if any. To learn how to operate, how to find your audience, how to do things with it. But the cool thing about what's going on right now, and it's massively cool, is that a couple of bodies of smart brains can access, outsource, open source, and reach into the ether and have mm-hmm. other people give them ideas, work with them, and create something where 10 people's 100, 100 people are 1,000, 1,000 people are 100,000. And you can do things you could never do before because you have so many outsourcing choices. This book also helps you find those and use those.
Yeah. I mean, I can't – it's almost inconceivable to imagine how powerful Google has become as a search engine of choice for so many of us, you know, or any search engine, really, in the 21st century. I can remember when colleagues were at Netscape, Peter, and this has got to be years ago.
I'm chortling.
They were just starting Netscape, and I was having lunch with one of the founders, and he said, blah, 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 browser. And I said, what's a browser, and what do we need it for? And here I am at the cutting edge of innovation and disruption, and I can't believe I said those words. He had to educate me about what it was, but we really didn't – we had Alta Vista, but we didn't really use that kind of stuff every day like we do 100 times a day now. So
– I'd be lost without the – I mean, I blog every day, and I've been doing it since 2008 as penance for political inactivity as a younger person. But bottom line, I my wife calls it questing. You give me a goal, and if I'm not tangentially distracted, I'll find anything that I can find very quickly. My hands fly across. I love it. It's so much fun. And I can't imagine if someone took that away from me, how depressed I would be.
Yeah, my mom calls me and says, you can find anything. Here's what I need. And I have to go look for the head of a pin, and I always tend to come up with it, but it's funny. So we're peeing a pot on that one, Peter. But, there are a lot of
peas on earth.
There are a lot of moving variables involved with communication and marketing, as we know. And one of them is this phenomenon of a smaller cohort defining what constitutes a generation in the commercially viable sense. What do you think the implications are when we talk about millennials, for example?
Well, first of all, I think that the notion of change is – it hit me in the head. I was reading about Ray Kurzweil's singularity theory.
Yep.
And basically his statement is if you look at the biggest change in the last 1,000 years – it's the acceleration of change itself. And if you take the year 2000 as 1 year unit of change and project it across this century, by the end of the century, you have 20,000 year units of change. And then you ask yourself, what does that mean? Because he came up with a lot of the theories, but it rocked my world. And I said, what do you do when you're young and things are whirling about you so quickly? Well, the one thing that happens, and I'm seeing it all the time, is history becomes less important because you're trying to figure out what's cool, what's next. And that's why I picked the title Next for my book. You have a lot of people who are living in hyper-accelerating times, and hyper-acceleration means things happen quicker in a shorter period of time. So that means
right.
If you're born today, your cohorts, the people that you share your psychographics, your attitudes, your, you know, your values, your historical knowledge, probably are within 2 or 3 years in any direction of your life, which means you've probably got a meaningful cohort of about 5 years. And if you look at someone who's a baby boomer, they've got a cohort of 20 years or even 25. So
right.
As you slide back from boomers into X into, you know, the every generation, millennials, et cetera, each cohort is shorter. I once asked my son when he was 27, said, hey, so what's it like graduating from college in this world? And he looked at me like, how would I know, Dad? I'm 27. I got nothing in common with those recent college grads.
Yeah.
And it's like, huh? Wow. And that's
yeah.
really the key. You really have to understand that your audience has segmented itself.
And they don't speak the same language.
They don't even speak. And it's funny when you say that. They don't feel things the same. They don't analyze things the same, they don't value things the same, and their vernacular is completely different. And
yeah.
if you try to mimic their vernacular and they don't feel that you're being true, they'll kill you.
Yeah, authenticity is everything today.
And that's one of the issues I hear a lot. I talk about it in the book. People talk about branding. To me, branding is what you do to cattle.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, people talk about their brand. What they really need to do is talk about their genuineness, their receptivity with the people that use or could use their product, and how that resonates with them emotionally and honestly.
Right.
And consistently.
And again, this goes back to the conduit between authenticity and transparency, and the fact that there are no secrets anymore. And that segues us back over to net neutrality, which I know you have your thumb on the pulse on there.
I'm writing an article, just told by my editors I'm 10,000 words too long.
It's your next book, Peter. But can you give us a little more meat on the bones about some of your perspective on how this is developing and why it's so important?
Well, first of all, net neutrality is just about paying for bandwidth and being able to prioritize higher speed things and slower things, et cetera, within the bandwidth. The problem
right.
with net neutrality is it's a technological bump, and everyone's looking about it so important. At a point in time where you have infinite bandwidth, it's irrelevant. If you have rich fiber to your home, net neutrality isn't an issue. Net neutrality is an issue when you're hovering somewhere in the 15 to 30 megabits per second bandwidth. When you're in that world, prioritization becomes really important. It's fascinating to note that FCC made their decision on February 26th, and what they basically did is they made a reclassification decision. What does that mean? Well, basically they're trying to regulate the cable industry, the internet bandwidth providers, the carriers, the same way they regulate broadcasters or telcos, like a public utility. And that gives them control over rates and bandwidth allocation and prioritization.
Yeah.
The battle ain't over. It's going to be litigation left, right, and center. We're a long way from settling this issue. And I'll also tell you that Standard & Poor's basically issued a warning after the net neutrality decision, downgrading the overall valuation perspective for cable internet providers.
Interesting.
Wow.
There's a
that
lot
was
more
a biggie.
I think we're just on the tip of the iceberg, but you know you're way down the well. You're deep in it.
Help me out.
Yeah, no kidding.
No, it matters because on the one hand, how do you rise above the clutter, which appears to be one of the great issues of our time? How does anybody, whether you're in marketing, entertainment, doesn't matter, what do I do to rise above the clutter? And you'll notice the major studios stood in the background during this battle because a lot of them said, hey, we could buy our way out of the clutter by prioritizing our signals on the web.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so they didn't, you're looking at a lot of people who are thinking, well, it's a bad thing. Netflix, which accounts for about 34% of the overall bandwidth usage, would love net neutrality. So do they have it? Has it been decided? And the answer is it's been decided subject to, court review. The Republican Party has said we're going to do everything in our power to pass legislation to disable this decision. And maybe they'll blend it in with Obamacare. I'm not sure how they're going to do that.
Yeah.
But the courts are very much a stumbling block, and the FCC has been slammed in the teeth recently in a lot of decisions just over issues like this. This is a biggie. And for you as a consumer, here's the secret path. I wrote about the net neutrality issue, but what's really going on is this huge merger between Time Warner and Comcast. Very famous for their wonderful, caring, loving service. Okay, not. Basically, with this new definition of 25 megabits a second, this merger covers half the country. And it's huge because here's the catch. If I can make internet access expensive enough for you, if all the costs of adding all the over-the-top, the OTT services, if you do it legally, I can make it as expensive as cable, then you won't disconnect cable. Oh, I also own the cable services. Did I mention that? Oh, yes. So
But in a world where we're trending towards cord cutting, how does a merger like that make sense?
It's awful. Because what it does is it makes cord cutting not necessarily remotely cheaper than cable subscription. And if you take a really hard look at other countries and see what they do, we're paying more among developed nations for cable, for high bandwidth access, whether you call it broadband or some other word. Different countries have different definitions of what that is. And it's not like we're 10 or 15% more. We're 2, 3, 4, 5 times more expensive.
Yep.
And that's the battle. It's about your wallet. Apparently, there are some big companies out there that don't believe you're paying enough for web access and or cable access, whatever you want to call it. That's the battle.
And, ultimately, of course, technology will figure that out. We'll get around that. And then when there's no more battle around the Internet access, then the cable providers will likely implode because of the trend towards cord cutting.
Well, it's complicated because remember when we had home video, for those of you who, when you had profit definitions at studios, they would include a 20% royalty into gross because that's what the record business did with its record royalties.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went to digital, they're claiming, well, there's all this manufacturing costs, all this other costs, so 20% is completely fair. It's the only way we can make money. But when digital came in and there were no longer these shipping and, printing and making costs, you just had a minor transmission fee, the 20% royalty went up to 25% even though the cost just went through the floor.
Yeah.
And the answer is, even if we wind up in a pure fiber universe, the people, the incumbents, may have so much power that they can charge de facto what they want. When you go to a movie theater and it's showing a digital movie and you don't have to ship a print to that theater, you're still, the theater owner is charging the studio a virtual print fee, $700-$800
right.
bucks a week, and there's no print.
Yeah.
And say, well, we're going to pay for our projectors.
Whatever they want.
How long does it take for a projector to get paid for?
Yeah. Very interesting dynamics afoot. Now, what does all this mean in your view, Peter, for the fate of the small indie film? Is it melodramatic to talk about its demise, or is that an unfortunate reality that we're facing?
Well, it's probably an interim phase, but right now the problem is, as we break up the market into those psychographics and the smaller demographics I was talking about, instead of marketing to two or three generations, you're now marketing to seven. And so the cost of marketing, despite the fact that you can do a lot of cool stuff that's a lot less expensive, the cost of marketing, because you have to send different messages over different media, has skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
The net impact on the motion picture industry has been the destruction of the independent film. If you look at the Academy Awards that we just had, the Oscars, somewhere between 16 to 18% fall in ratings because the movies that are being touted or talked about aren't the movies that people are going to see. And the small movies, as much as there's a lot of pride in it, there's a whole bunch of hubris among, the younger generations, and I hate to use the word millennials because I'm not sure what it is anymore, given my own theories. But they're saying, hey, if it looks like a film I could have made, I'm not paying money to see it. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
What? And it is a devaluation of content unless there's some sort of extrinsic imprimatur, like a theatrical release on it. Every year there are 4,000 to 5,000 feature films made in the English language. Of that total, under 2% ever get picked up for anything that remotely significant in terms of U.S. distribution.
And then how do we reconcile those factoids with movies like Hot Tub Time Machine 2 when you wonder how in the world does that get made?
Well, probably because Hot Tub Time Machine 1 made a lot of money.
Or
but at the end of the day, our falling educational system, our standards dropping through the floor, basically dumbs down a large segment of the audience.
Oh, drives me crazy.
I'm already crazy.
Do you think television will manage to step in and fill that gap in terms of what's happening with binge watching and the Netflix transition? And any thoughts about the television side?
Well, there's a bunch of mixed feelings here. Number one, there are X number of people in the domestic market. It's, 300 and something million people.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get 20%, 30%, 40% bigger. So every time you are generating, entertainment to an audience, something else has to give. It's not an audience, it's not a situation where we're infinitely expanding opportunities. In the last 12 years, the average American has actually made less in terms of buying power year after year than at any time in recent history. Every year, a little bit less. So you now look at this and say, there are approximately 63 buyers of what I will call scripted as opposed to reality television.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's the sweet spot. When I say scripted television, it includes digital networks as well as traditional networks.
Yep.
By the way, you might hate this, but in analyzing what television scripted likes other than comedy, it comes down to two categories, process shows, like, you know, how do I solve a problem? How do I solve a crime? How do I run the Department of State? How do I run a hospital? How do I run a police department? How do I run a law firm? How do I...
Food network, yeah.
That kind of stuff. Or yeah. Nasty people doing nasty things to even nastier people.
Yeah, which again shocks me as to how that gets on, but okay.
But that's what we have today in the world of a lot of television. Personal drama has almost left the motion picture arena unless it's based upon something like a best-selling book. If
uh-huh.
it's not got a built-in pre-audience, personal drama is dead, but not in television. The problem with television, networks are about generating loyalty over time. Sustainability, I think, is the right word. And
loyalty
so if you,
show, not right, for the network.
Well, for it, to the show. And
yeah.
That's what producers, basically, of television want. So if you're selling a one-shot, like a movie for television, that market's almost gone.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, indie filmmakers tend to think in those smaller one-shot segments.
Well, hang on, there has to be an exception here. If you're making things for the Hallmark Channel or Lifetime and they're going straight to those channels, that might be
I represent
exception.
One of the major suppliers to both of those channels, and those are you also have sci-fi. There are a few of them. Hallmark's demographics are even older than I am, and we don't want to go into that. And Lifetime basically is targeting middle-aged women, so that's their core audience. If you're trying to get younger people engaged in personal drama, it don't happen no how.
Right. Got it. So that said, let's say you're an aspiring filmmaker or you want to produce something for television. What other avenues might people that are younger that need distribution take advantage of instead to channel that passion and get something seen?
Well, we have one of the things that you find fascinating about the mainstream entertainment industry is it's profoundly insecure, profoundly stupid, and constantly looking for what's next as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what is what's next? Since the only thing they understand is numbers, at the end of the day, what you're going to try to do is generate content and repeatability with numbers. And there are YouTube kings, there are people who've done, created product on channels, who've created characters that keep coming back, and they wind up becoming unbelievable celebrities before the networks can get to them.
Mm-hmm.
They're the power players today. And I think the ability to create cool content, do your own show, 5-minute, 10-minute, who cares what it is, just make it shockingly compelling. YouTube is certainly a way to go. There are lots of other places to do it. You can even launch your own, but the name of the game is to build your social network so that enough people see it that
yeah.
it starts rippling in the
By the way, this is the very same advice, Peter, that I give on behalf of having been a former record label exec to rising musicians. You must build your own audience through social media and people that will come see the live show before any label exec will even remotely be interested.
And remember, television is primarily, most television and motion pictures is various degrees of voyeurism. I hate to say it,
right.
but it is what it is.
Yeah.
And the ability to make people not realize they're watching something and be unable to turn it off and want more is just amazing. Binge viewing has changed things. It's funny how it started. Binge viewing, there's a show called 24, which has been resurrected. But 24 was basically done by Fox, and they finished with it, and then they figured, we got hundreds of episodes, we're going to make a fortune. So they went to local television stations, the old syndication model, where you sell your show to local stations to run in the other time periods.
Right.
And nobody wanted it. They were shocked, and they said, well, you see, the problem with your show is, it's contiguous. One episode leads to the next episode leads to the next episode. So if you're not a constant viewer, it doesn't sell so well.
Right.
So they kind of dumped it and said, okay, we lose. We spent a lot of money on the show. We're a big company. We don't need to worry about it. And then someone started looking at the revenues. And people were, one way or another, watching accumulations of episodes over a short period of time, like a weekend.
Right.
And they would be watching it all day and all night. And the revenues started to pour in, and we discovered binge watching.
And, of course, House of Cards played a role in that, too.
House of Cards basically just it took that model and said, okay, what if we start where 24 left off?
Yeah.
And why don't we
really pick that up and ran with it?
And they're very star-oriented because their target audience tends to be a little bit older as well as now roping in the younger audiences.
Yep.
So now all that said, what do you see coming down the pipeline in the next 2 to 5 years? Is your crystal ball, what do you see in the tea leaves there?
Well, my view, first of all, is that incumbents with massive amounts of stages and lots of overhead and lots of very expensive technology and massive amounts of labor are going to have a lot of trouble because the cost factors, when you fractionalize an audience as much as we fractionalize the audience with so much content, you are not going to be able to generate as much value. Now, look at the major studios. They were releasing a whole pile of movies. They reduced their distribution releasing slate by 30%, and revenues went up. But then they also started paying more money for production value. So some of the cost savings went the other way.
Yep.
I think the lesson to be learned here is learn how to use other people's infrastructure expenditures as if they were your own. Do not pay for them. And those that have the infrastructure are going, they have a heroin addiction without the benefits.
Right.
They constantly have to upgrade. You know, when you started off with 3D animation, you had two players, PDI and Pixar.
Right.
And they battled, and each one of them has over 2,000 or around 2,000 employees, plus or minus. And now there are like 15 companies around the world that can generate that level of animated quality.
Yeah, PDI / DreamWorks is what you meant to say.
Well, it started off as PDI, and DreamWorks acquired them.
Right, DreamWorks
Animation. So it was PDI and Pixar at first, and then DreamWorks said, okay, we can do that. We're going to take it. We're going to buy it. We're going to merge it. And that's where it came from.
And, of course, now what we're seeing on the DreamWorks side is, you know.
Not pretty.
Trouble in Little China for that very reason, for the bloat.
Well, it's A, they have too many employees.
Fit.
B,
yeah.
They're a publicly traded company that releases 2 or 3 movies a year. That's too up and down, ziggy-zaggy for stock value. So they had to go public because they needed to pay off some debt. Their creative people are great, but being public when you have that little diversity and that, it's just nuts.
And unlike Pixar, sadly, as much as I love the DreamWorks, you know, everything about DreamWorks historically and what it's all about, they don't have a track record of having consistent, nonstop blockbusters from a profitability and a revenue standpoint like Pixar does.
Well, Pixar is now remaking itself. I mean, you know,
obviously
we can go from
business.
Boats to cars to planes to,
you
know, there's a lot of that going on. And every once in a while, something unbelievable will happen. Frozen was an extraordinary event, but it was not a Pixar-generated movie, even though John Lasseter got an EP credit on, executive producer credit on it.
Right.
But, you know, part of the understanding here is if you got a big marketing machine and you have a brand, you put the word Disney on a motion picture or Pixar on a motion picture, and every mom and dad knows that their kids are going to like the movie. And more importantly, the mom and dad are going to like going.
I was
going to
say,
kid.
So will they.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, I always point out that Chris Meledandri in his first Despicable Me movie, in which you have Bank of Evil, and then below it says formerly known as Lehman Brothers. That's multi-generational. Very cool. Very, very good.
He's double entendres like we had back in the day, and I'm going to date myself with Rocky and Bullwinkle, you know.
Oh, that trick never works.
We
pull a rabbit out of my hat. Can't help myself. I love those. Those are some of the finest little things out there. The Durwood Kirby. Yeah, I got it. Okay.
All these double entendres so that the adults would enjoy it as much as the kids.
And
well,
I think that's actually very important to understand. When you make programming for children, younger children, you basically got a 3 to 8 years. That's the age group. After 8, the kids want to see what the older kids are looking at. It's a very, very, very narrow demo. So you really die because you can't put a lot of money into that tiny little demo. If you don't buy the older kids and parents in that medium, you really don't have a shot at making the big bucks that studios have to have.
And I think it's masterful to aim towards that multi-generational direction. As we know, there's some things coming down the pike there that we're not quite ready to talk about today.
But I do think that's where things are headed in my crystal ball.
I think multi-generational entertainment, first of all, the numbers are staggering. If you look at the top 20 movies the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you'll find 70 or 80% of the top performers actually fit within that description.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, when you're looking at the big screen for the kind of phenomenon, it's great. If you're going to go play niche, that's going to be very targeted television channels.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to get into the motion picture business and you're doing niche, that would have worked 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It's not going to work today.
Understood and agreed. Well, Peter, you've been very generous with your time, but before we finish our chat, I always like to end these conversations with what I feel is one of the most important questions, and that is, with all the wonderful things you're involved with, what comes next for you? What's the one project or collaboration you've not yet started that you dream about creating or launching as a next phase?
Well, I've recently acquired a lustful leer at what I will call hard patents, not software patents. And I'm looking at a small coterie of patent attorneys and entrepreneurs who seem to have access to university patents at the highest levels and are looking to try to figure out how to create a small private equity fund around that and then create larger rolling funds to do two things: finish the final mile of patent work. Most academic patents aren't ready to be licensed out into the world. They need more patent work on them.
Mm-hmm.
And do this to license and sell those out into the world. So that's one thing. And the other is a hush-hush, top-secret thing that, unfortunately, you know way too much about.
Indeed. We know about, but it has to remain a secret for the moment.
It has to remain a secret because we're in the process of putting that together, and it's still
and
happening
too,
in a
share your
big
enthusiasm
way.
For that one. So that'll be our next one down the road, and we can talk about it.
I think so.
So thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciated having you as my guest on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And as always, I also like to thank my wonderful show producer, Jessica Mastor, and our wonderful listeners who are with us each and every week. Have a great week, everybody. We'll hear you again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.